The obvious question that we might want to address when we're looking at history is where our current system came from. And the great difficulty with that is that there's a long history of the development of services before the present system came into place. The poor laws lasted in one form or another for about 350 years in England and subsequently in the United Kingdom, because they precede the United Kingdom. The laws begin, for practical purposes, in Tudor times, and this is following the attempts to try to change the way that charity is distributed by the monasteries. So it's Henry VIII who introduces a poor law in the 1530s in an attempt to try to put in a different system, one that wouldn't, in the way that people thought the monasteries did, encourage people to be poor and encourage them particularly to move across the land. Now, in many ways, that reflects a modern debate. We've still got the same idea that we're concerned about migrants, we're concerned about strangers, we're concerned about people who are moving, looking for funds from other people. And it's been going on actually rather longer even than the 16th century. It really, in Britain, the feudal system was very much challenged and broke down in many places because of the Black Death, which is a couple of hundred years before. And people were always moving and not tied to land and ready to go from place to place. The Tudor legislation, which I've referred to, was initially fairly punitive in a way that the European counterparts often weren't. It's a real surprise to look back at stuff that was written 500 years ago and to discover that there was a social organisation of charity that's in one of the cities which I've done work on, which is Ypres in Belgium, that even had what we might consider to be a health service with free medical care being provided by the city. This remains the position through to the formation of the first national act, the Elizabethan Poor Law. It's conventionally dated from 1601. There's actually a preliminary piece of legislation in 1598, which is pretty much the same thing. But that lasts from 1601 in one form or another, right the way through to 1948. And it's usually referred to from 1601 to 1834 as the Old Poor Law, while the legislative change in the 1830s is introduced as the New Poor Law. So what did the Old Poor Law say? Well, basically the Old Poor Law was an attempt to have some kind of national organization of welfare provision for poor people throughout the country. This largely relied on local organizations, the overseers of the poor. The idea was that there would be rates levied in the cities, that that would pay for the provision, that poor people would be housed as necessary or looked after, or the term was set on work. So setting the poor on work was one of the themes. Although this dates from 1601, the truth of it is that the system didn't really develop in those terms afterwards. It's been said at times that making acts of parliament in Britain is a national sport, and there really weren't the mechanisms in place for the poor law to be a reality. Remember too that during the 17th century we have a civil war, so there's a lot of these things that become disrupted. But there's also lots of ways that people try during the period of the Old Poor Law to try and make sure that they're only looking after their poor, the local poor, and that they're not trying to deal with people coming through from outside. We have some occasional experiments used in places, and I'm going to use two examples. One of them is that in some places, poor people were given a badge to wear so that people would know that these were paupers and that the people would be properly ashamed of it. Another example was the development of laws of what were called settlement and removal, somebody had a settlement in a parish if they were born there, if they lived there, so that when they became destitute, the parish became responsible for them. So we also have laws of removal, making sure that, for example, if a woman was pregnant and about to have a baby, she'd be taken and dumped over the parish boundary, that's the removal part, so that the baby wouldn't have a settlement. It would be quite wrong to say this is universal, because although the laws are there, although they're on the books, and the way in which it's actually practiced is very different from place to place. Now, of course, the big social changes come about in Britain, not so much in Elizabethan times, though clearly there are areas like London which had started to be very different from the rest of the country even as early as that. The big changes come during what we call the Industrial Revolution. And the Industrial Revolution is characterized mainly by a movement of people away from traditional occupations and agriculture into urban centers. And that gradually takes off through the 18th century and takes off really very rapidly after 1780. There's a word of caution I should probably add to this. I'm talking about very big periods of time. We tend to think now of the period, say, 1780 to 1820 as being a time of massive change. And it is a time of massive change, but that's 40 years. And for many people, that's a lifetime. We've got to understand that a lot of the changes, the pressures that people felt, changed the society completely, but they weren't all happening instantly overnight. It's something that builds up over time. During the 18th century, there are laws which are passed, first of all, to try to make poor law administrations more efficient, trying to get them to work together, to pool resources. But also, there are laws which are introduced saying that where they've got accommodation, this should be what is called a poor house. It shouldn't be a workhouse, which some people had tried out. Now, that law, as like with many other laws, actually gets ignored in lots of places. And after the Napoleonic Wars, with soldiers coming back from fighting, with people being visibly unemployed, but also with the changes in the industrial towns, increasing numbers of young women coming to the towns and having children, shock horror, out of wedlock, there's massive concerns with the burden for the poor rates in particular areas which have grown beyond all proportions that were imaginable previously and which have got a problem of poverty to be dealt with. So some places after 1815 start to experiment with the deterrent workhouse. This is the idea that you make life unpleasant for poor people. What people had been saying in the 18th century before was, look, when I was a young person, people were ashamed to claim benefit. Now they are absolutely happy to get the resources of the poor law behind them, and it's only old people who are ashamed. And the bizarre thing about that statement is that you can find it in 1780, 1810, 1840, right the way up to the present day, and people still believe it's true today. And of course, if it was true the first time, it couldn't have been true the second time, and so it goes on. But this is one of the recurring myths of British politics, that it was different 30 years ago. Well, obviously everything's different from 30 years ago, but not that. People have always ashamed to claim. So we get the deterrent workhouses, which are a transformation of the previous purpose into the period, as it is, after the Napoleonic Wars. At the time, there are three big intellectual arguments being put. One of those intellectual arguments comes from Thomas Malthus. It's the idea that the poor are breeding beyond our capacity to feed them. And the intention then is to try to limit the surplus population. Don't feed them because it only encourages them. Then you've got the work of Jeremy Bentham, who held that people's main motivation is either pain or pleasure. If you want them not to do things, you've got to make it unpleasant. Bentham actually wanted much more deterrent provision than we've currently got, or even, I think, than was introduced in the 1834 reforms. But he wasn't completely successful as a political analyst and thinker. For example, he wanted his model prison to be built, and it never was, because people were being transported to Australia instead. But nevertheless, this has a huge influence on the way that people think about welfare. The third thing is the growth of the new economics, particularly as represented by David Ricardo. And Ricardo says, wages will always, according to an iron law, tend to the minimum that people need to survive, and that if you undercut the position of people who are working, they will starve. And there was a view that the provisions made in the old poor law had that effect, that they were undercutting workers. One example, because workers were being taken in to the poorhouses and then hired out to local employers. This was called the roundsman system. And also because low wages were being subsidized in what was called outrelief. He argued that it was economically inevitable. It's called the iron law of wages. If you pay people more than the minimum they need to survive, you'll get more people wanting to work, and so the wages will be forced down by the competition. If you pay them less, they will starve, and then you'll have a labour shortage and the wage will go up. That was very influential for one of the members of the Poor Law Commission, Nassau Senior. We then get, basically under the influence of the three movements which I've mentioned, as well as the experiments that have been made with deterrent workhouses, we get this brought together in the Poor Law Report of 1834. The Poor Law Report of 1834, as it's generally known, is basically argues that the effect of the laxity of the old poor law has been to encourage a lot of things we don't want, worklessness and, in particular, what they call bastardy, which we would now call illegitimacy. That it's encouraging feckless women to have babies irresponsibly. And that's the Malthusian element coming in. So you want a deterrent principle. The basic principles that they come up with are generally named as two principles. The first is called the workhouse test. There should be no relief offered by the poor law except for the relief in the workhouse. So everybody has to go into the workhouse. And what they argue about the workhouse is that this will be comforting to old and sick people, but it will be a horror for people who are idle and unemployed because they're going to be made to work. The second thing that they argue is a principle that's called less eligibility. And this is the principle that people's circumstances should never be more to be chosen if they are without work than if they're in work. So every pauper must be worse off than every labourer. That's the principle. And of course, we still have the same thing now in the arguments about being better off on the dole, which have nothing to do with economic models of incentives. If you're concerned about incentives, you look, what was the person's wage before? What is their benefit now? Are they better off or worse off? And most continental systems on that model have got far more generous benefits than we've got. What we do is we compare the situation of every person on benefit with every person in work. So the same principle is still there in British politics. Now, that was what was introduced in the 1834 poor law legislation. As is often the case, this doesn't get implemented perfectly. I've already commented that there were the mechanisms before. Well, the 1834 poor law was much better at creating its mechanisms. It had the National Poor Law Commission. It had the overseers of the poor, later the guardians of the poor, reporting to them, and it had a much better grip on what was going on. But there were a couple of problems, and one was that the condition of workers outside was so thoroughly dreadful that, frankly, the poor law couldn't make it any worse. You get accusations that the workhouses are pauper palaces, that they're places of relative luxury. I mean, people get fed. And very famously, there was a scandal in the 1840s at the end of the workhouses where the paupers weren't getting fed, and that was a national scandal. But it's what there were workers outside who were starving as well. So simply the poorhouse, the workhouse couldn't be worse. And because it couldn't be worse, they came increasingly to rely on what was called the stigma of the poor law, the sense of shame, the sense that it was humiliating. And that was deliberately encouraged by many of the people responsible for the workhouses, because that was the only way that they could see of holding up the barriers. Now, the new poor law is important in lots of other ways, and it's not just because of the survival. They succeeded in a way that the old poor law hadn't, in getting a national administration in place. So what happened next is that as central government wanted to find ways of implementing practical improvements for people's lives, there was really only the poor law for them to work with. In some places, you had traditional local government. The old county boroughs, for example, existed. Scotland had a developed system of local government, but England didn't. And there'd be a mishmash of different people. So where did they go to, for example, when they wanted to start building sewers? And the answer is, it went to the guardians of the poor. Then public nuisances and trying to manage issues in public health went to the guardians of the poor. And then in the 1870s, when we started having hospitals built, for example, for people who were mentally ill, for people who with learning and developmental disabilities, those were all lumped together, typically in buildings, in institutions that were created and managed by the poor law. And the poor law becomes effectively, through the development of its education system in the 1840s, 50s and 60s, through the development of the health system, it becomes the foundation of pretty much everything that we have in the social services. One of the ironies of the hospital system we've got is that if you see a hospital with the name infirmary attached, it was probably a poor law hospital at some point, and it would have been one of the hospitals that got absorbed into the national health system eventually. Hospitals ceased to be the responsibility of the poor law when local government got developed in the 1870s and 80s, and then later what happened is that that local government lost control of the some of the things that it got, but particularly in the period, the high point of local government for health is in the 1930s, and then 1948, all the poor law stuff goes over somewhere else. So the poor law is gradually dismantled as the alternative agencies and mechanisms grow and exist. The why is, I think, the easy answer. That's because we had some major social changes with the Industrial Revolution and the movement of people to the cities, meaning that there was a large set of problems which required appropriate administration. The poor law before 1834 is disorganized in modern terms. It's not that there's no organization, it's that it's a bit haphazard as to what you get and where you get it. There are laws that don't really encapsulate the spirit of the times. The law which said, for example, that there shouldn't be a workhouse. Clearly it was disregarded by the people who were developing the deterrent workhouses. The famous ones were at Bingham and Southall in Nottinghamshire. The Southall workhouse, by the way, is now in the hands of the National Trust. can go to visit it. The 1834 law does change everything, and it's seen, therefore, very clearly as a watershed moment. It changes things because from there we get the development of a new set of services. But you can see what's happened. Why did we develop public health in the poor law? Because there really wasn't any other way of doing it. There weren't the mechanisms there to make it possible to start dealing with public health menaces. I think the other thing is that apart from being more systematic and more organized, they're also much more explicitly punitive. This is part of the ethos that's being put through. The fact that I'm able to say, here are the central principles of the new poor law, it's much more difficult to tell you that there are central principles of the old poor law. What I described in relation to the old poor law were a series of fairly haphazard and sometimes inconsistent initiatives being done differently in different places. Under the new poor law, we have a deliberately deterrent regime being directed from the Poor Law Commission at the centre, and subsequently becoming the foundation for lots of other services because nothing else was there. So we see from the poor law the system of health, we see the system of, well, not all education, but actually a substantial number of precedents in education before education becomes universal in England in the 1870s, and local government, where the local government system grows out, especially in rural areas, of the poor law guardians. From here, we move to a period which is the foundation of a social service state, following particularly the Liberal government of the early 20th century. And what happens here is that people have come to mistrust and despise the poor law. What is it? People, that's obviously the people who use it. It's the people who don't want to use it. It's the politicians, with the growth of what's going to become later the Labour Party, but which initially has many people in the Liberal Party, representing trades unions, working classes, and others. So what we then get are a series of measures which are intended to escape from the poor law. And the measure, now, some of those work, some of them don't. We have old age pensions introduced in the 1908 Act. That has got a bit of moral conditionality attached. It's not available to people who've previously been paupers. It's not what we would now call a means test, but actually formally speaking, it's for people below a certain income. It's just that the vast majority of people were below that income level. That system lasted only until 1925 because it proved to be too expensive. They moved to a contributory system because that had a way of raising money to pay for it. But that's an attempt, clearly, to break away from the poor law. During the period between the wars, we tried to break away from the poor law much more substantially in lots of ways. And I would point here particularly to the development of unemployment assistance. Now, that word wouldn't have been used throughout most of that period. It's an expression that is used only from 1934 onwards, when we have the Unemployment Assistance Board. But after the First World War, we get what are called out-of-work donations, which then become, I think, transitional payments and so on. And this is the origins of the means test. The means test is for people who are poor, but the purpose of the means test is to break away from the poor law. It's to be able to give people relief, support, help, without turning them into paupers. And it's, of course, what happens is that the administration of the means test is very harsh, it's very much under pressure, it becomes just as despised as the poor law, and in many people's minds, it's part of that poor law mentality. What Orwell is describing in The Road to Wigan Pier about the means test, about the shame, the humiliation, is actually, bizarrely, an attempt that had been made to try to do it without the stigma of pauperism. That we get the gradual development. So Hospitals are taken away finally from poor laws and others into the 1930s. But for the most part, the watershed is the Second World War. In the Second World War, government had taken over lots of facilities centrally anyway. Then we have, in the middle of the war, in one of its darkest periods, the publication of the Beveridge Report. By reputation, Churchill didn't actually like or approve of the Beveridge Report and didn't want to publish it. Indeed, Beveridge himself hadn't really been interested in the report, according to his biographer, Jose Harris. When he was given the task of Social Security instead of what he thought was important, he was in tears. But Beveridge leaked the report to make sure that it got out. It was a bestseller. And in the course of the war, it was, believe it or not, dropped by parachute into enemy territory to explain to people what it was that the Allies were fighting for. What we get in the the period after the Second World War is a commitment to a new sort of regime, one that is very deliberately going to break away from the ethos of the poor law. The system up until then had been a system for poor people, for people who were destitute. Instead, we were going to have a system that was going to be for everyone. The Beveridge scheme, if you look at the details, some of them now look slightly bizarre, has classes of insurance for everyone, including people who can't possibly hope to pay any contributions. So pensioners have a class, children have a class. And the reason for that is Beveridge is trying to emphasize this is universal, it's for absolutely everybody. It will be there as of right. When we have the welfare state introduced, 1948, and by coincidence, and we haven't mentioned the date, it is the 7th of July, which is the anniversary of the foundation of the coming into force of the welfare state, we get a series of acts which are designed to come in simultaneously, all at the same time. And those are the National Insurance Act of 1946, the National Health Services Act, the National Assistance Act. The Children Act is actually in the same year, but I'm not sure it's the same implementation date. So we have, you know, a quite deliberate attempt to say the welfare state from now on will be different. It won't be about poverty anymore. It will be services for everyone. It will be services at the best level possible. And it'll be given as a right without the humiliation and stigma of the poor law. The hospitals, which have gone from poor law to local authority, go into a national health service. One of the importances of a national service is it's not going to be a local service because people are iffy about local services. Local authorities lose a huge amount of power in the creation of the welfare state. But if we go back to the high point of local government in the 1930s, local government had been responsible for health, for social security, for police, for fire, for gas, for electricity. All of these things go. After the war, well, during the war, effectively. But yes, local authorities are a shadow of what they have been up till then. Why didn't we not want local authorities to carry on managing social assistance as is done in much of the rest of Europe? Well, the answer is, of course, that it's all tainted with the poor law and the means test. This is the world we don't want anymore. So what you get in social security is a strictly bureaucratic system being done with no discretion from individual officers working directly with people, because that's what we had in the poor law. That's what we don't have anymore. In the case of health, there's an irony, and the irony is, of course, that we're often talking about heavily dependent people in the same buildings that have been made by the poor law. So the psychiatric hospitals, many of them have been built in a wave in the 1870s, another large wave was built in the 1920s, and of course the NHS inherits the buildings, and it inherits the same people in the same place. You will have heard it said, for example, that at this time there would have been women admitted to psychiatric care because they'd had an illegitimate child. Now, that would have happened under the 1913 Mental Deficiency Act, I think it was, when there was a class of what were called moral defectives. And, of course, somebody could well be in that hospital in 1948 and could have carried on living there into the 1970s. So we have these sorts of legacy within the creation of the welfare state. But the welfare state is intended to be different. What then happens in the welfare state is that slowly, I think, people initially have a confidence. We have dealt with these problems. And then they discover, or start to discover in the 1960s, with what's been called the rediscovery of poverty, that actually there's a number of failings. Initially, the failings are identified in relation to older people. And the part of the reason is that older people aren't getting the benefits they're supposed to be getting. And people say, well, it's because the system hasn't matured enough, or because these people have the attitudes of the days of the poor law and they don't want to be dependent. But as time goes on, it becomes more and more clear that's not the case. This is why the National Assistance Scheme is changed in 1966 to supplementary benefit. It's the idea that you can recreate the benefits and make them more acceptable. But we carry on getting this idea that it's the legacy of the poor law we have to deal with. In the 1970s, there's a huge set of attempts to try to close down a lot of the old poor law institutions. The Labour government in the mid-70s was closing hospitals hand over fist on the basis that it wasn't efficient, that they were old buildings, and it really wasn't thought of as being appropriate. And if you've got two half-empty hospitals within close proximity, the rational thing to do is to close one of them. So we get lots of movements of that sort. Pretty much, though, from the early 70s onwards, we have a regrowth of many of the ideologies that have been dominant in the 1930s, about what a sound economy looks like, about how government ought to manage, and about how poor people ought to be managed. The Heath government reintroduces a number of means-tested benefits, or rather shifts the balance towards means-testing. An example would be that they reduced the subsidy of council housing to a very large extent, trebling rents and requiring, therefore, the creation of what at the time was called a rent rebate and later became part of the housing benefit system, instead of giving the subsidy to the housing. And this is fueled by a set of market principles which says that individual benefits are better than collective benefits are. So we have the growth of means testing, and we have more and more focus of the political debate onto the recipients, very often in words that reflect the attitudes and beliefs of the poor law. I've given an example very early on there when I was talking about less eligibility, which is the complaint that people are better off on the dole, which is still very much seen in the way it was in the 1830s. You know, most countries will look and say, how much was somebody getting before? They're getting half as much now. That shows they have an incentive to work. In Britain, we hold it down. So we actually find that what's called the replacement ratio in Social Security, this is how much benefit you get as a proportion of the wage you had before. In Britain, we have one of the lowest replacement ratios in the developed world. This is why the Council of Europe has said that Britain's unemployment benefits are manifestly inadequate. In formal terms, we've moved from what's called a residual system of welfare, that is something which is there to deal with people who are destitute, to deal with a small number of people, and we move from that towards a mass system of welfare. But increasingly, we've seen since, in modern times, a movement back towards the same kind of residual arguments and very often the same political arguments that we heard in the days of the poor law. What tends to happen is that ideas don't get completely forgotten. They get recycled in one form or another. I've given a specific example of that, which was the way that the arguments on less eligibility have been recycled into arguments that are supposed to be about incentives, but actually don't have much in practice to do with incentives. And I'm reading this from a Daily Telegraph article. A system designed as a safety net for the most vulnerable has swelled into an all-consuming client state which stifles aspiration and dignity. Since the Second World War, a welfare system established to end privation and act as a safety net for those in difficulties has become all pervasive. Now, that is completely wrong. It was the poor law that was designed as the safety net for the most vulnerable. The welfare system designed after the Second World War was designed to be comprehensive and to cover everybody, in the popular phrase of the time, from the cradle to the grave. But it's the idea that in retrospect, we look back at the way that the world should be and we start to re-represent it in terms which actually have no foundation in terms in sense of what was going on. But you can see in what I've just read out there, a clear expression of the principles of the poor law.